Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. President Biden is in Europe on his first international trip. That's more than a week long, starting in the United Kingdom, where he and Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed a new version of the Atlantic Charter. The G7 meeting of the world's leading economic powers is happening in person for the first time since the pandemic. Next week, the president will attend a NATO ministerial where the United States and its allies might find themselves at odds over Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg's plan to spend more money. The meetings are a way for the United States to coordinate its policy on Russia and China with its allies before the president meets next week with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva. Meanwhile, back in Washington, the Pentagon is adopting policy changes in the wake of a four-month China task force to better align the Defense Department to address the threats posed by Beijing. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin defended the administration's $715 billion military spending request for 2022. And while Biden called off direct infrastructure talks with Republicans, a bipartisan group of 10 senators appear to have struck a $1 trillion infrastructure deal. The question is whether it will get the support of Democrats and Republicans. Lawmakers try to shoot for a 60 vote on the measure as opposed to doing it through reconciliation. Joining us today is our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. Joining us are Dr. Patrick Cronin, who is the director of the Asia program at the Hudson Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Europe chief at the Pentagon, Jim Townsend, who is now with the Center for a New American Security, and former Pentagon comptroller, Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us.
Vago, it's great to be here.
Great to be back, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Good to be here, Vago.
An absolute pleasure having you guys back on. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. Michael, welcome back from a restful time off, although I know having exchanged emails with you and texts with you over the course of your vacation, you seem to be actually working pretty hard. Talk to us a little bit about what's going on the Hill. Hearings underway, but also infrastructure talks, NDAA discussions. Walk us through what you think were sort of the key happenings over the course of the last week, and what to expect in the coming week.
Okay, sure. Well, infrastructure remains, you know, the top item for folks. So as we've talked about previously, the president has been engaged in some bipartisan discussions with Senator Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia. However, those talks broke down earlier this week. They had a phone call that lasted for less than 5 minutes where they broke off discussions. Biden issued, a nice positive statement, but, Capito was saying that their this whole communication that they've had has really been, there's been a lot of misunderstanding and things that they really were not able to overcome. However, Biden is still committed to a bipartisan compromise. And right away, he reached out to a group of bipartisan senators, 10 senators, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and he reached out to Senator Cassidy in that group. And I think the reason he reached out to Senator Cassidy was that Senator Cassidy has been working closely with Congressman Josh Gottheimer over on the House side, because Gottheimer co-chairs the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is a group of 29 Democrats and 29 Republicans. I think it's really a key item here because the House has been kind of left out of these discussions. And I had a discussion with some folks in the Republican House leadership last week, and they noted that they've been left out of these bipartisan discussions on infrastructure. And Gottheimer's group was working on a proposal of about $1.25 trillion, which was higher than the Capito number. And that's the one that Cassie and his group feel that they will be coming up to. And actually, it was announced last night that there is a deal on infrastructure for about $1.2 trillion. But the deal is only among those 10 bipartisan senators. It's not agreed to among the larger conference. It's not agreed to with the president. So we shouldn't get too excited just yet for a variety of reasons, too. I mean, first of all, this group only has 5 Republicans in it, and we would need 10 Republicans in order to get cloture and pass it. And these five Republicans are different than the ones that Capito was working with. Capito had the backing of Mitch McConnell and the other ranking members on the committees. This group, while it's a great group of senators, is not as influential with their conference. Also, the details are not totally released yet, but pay-fors is going to be a problem with this bill. One of the pay-fors supposedly is indexing the gas tax for inflation, and that's really going to be a no-go with Biden and his folks because he is committed to not raising taxes on people who make less than $400,000 a year. And it's also assuming that every Democrat would go along with this if they got 10 Republicans. And that's just not the case. Many Democrats continue to draw those red lines. We've talked to them about them in previous contact podcasts. Senator Ed Markey again this week said, no climate, no deal. You know, Senator Heinrich also says any infrastructure package that's light on climate change and clean energy cannot count on all the votes within the Democratic conference. So, you know, I think that the jury's out still. I think even if there is a way to get a bipartisan compromise on infrastructure, there still will be a push to do a larger reconciliation package to include the things that the progressives especially feel are being left out of this bill. So I think there's still a long way to go. Now, the Senate's really been focusing on a lot of things that are not going to become law. I mean, they've been focusing on and will be when they get back in session, voting rights, police reform. They're still, I think, going to vote on the January 6th commission. But they did pass a bill the other day aimed at countering China to help companies better compete with China. The bill's gone through several names. It was called the Endless Frontiers Bill. Now it's the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. And, you know, it authorizes...
And that's the $250 billion measure that passed through the Senate that's now going to the House.
Exactly, right. Now, going to the House, that's another issue, right? Because the House is going to write their own bill. This is why this still has an uphill battle. So the House is marking up several different measures, which they will then combine into their own package. And, you know, the chances of success there are still not clear. And then it would have to go to conference. So, and even if this bill does become law, it is an authorization bill. There's really not money behind it. And there, it's got a lot of opposition. I mean, in the Senate, 31 Republicans did oppose the bill, but one of which, you know, was Senator Inhofe, who is the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee. He feels that this is incomplete, that if we're going to be talking about challenging China, that we should be talking about defense funding and defense modernization as well. So I think this bill still has a way to go. You know, so what, you know, I think I was talking to a senior Democrat the other day, and, you know, we want to keep our eye on the ball and make sure, at least as far as the defense community is concerned, to make sure that we get appropriations bills done and get the NDAA done. And there is a strong recognition among the Democrats and the Republicans that in order to get the NDAA passed, they're going to need Republican votes, and they do not plan to put anything controversial in the bill. And there will be a battle to make sure that controversial provisions stay out during amendment process and the full committee markup, as well as when the bill gets to the floor.
The one observation I would have for Democrats at this point is just don't have the votes, right? And you don't have the votes in the Senate, and Manchin and Sinema have to go along with it. And if they don't, your choice is either I'm going to get everything I want or I'm going to get part of what I want. And I think where the president is, he's a creature of the body. He knows how to count votes. And at the end of the day, yes, if you don't have Manchin and Sinema, you don't have a deal.
Well,
whether or not you like it or not, or whether progressives like it or not. So the choice is, what do we do? And the Republicans know that. And Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema know that.
I agree. But I think it's bigger than Manchin and Sinema. I've talked to several chiefs of staff on the Senate side who are Democrats who are saying Manchin is saying what a lot of other people are thinking. Right. You know, look, give me an example. I mean, Senator Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire is going to be in a very tough re-election, especially if Governor Sununu runs against her. Is she going to want to vote for a reconciliation package that raises taxes and also, gives away free college, free universal pre-K, a lot of things that are not going to appeal to middle-of-the-road voters? I don't think so. In the House, Pelosi can only afford to lose about four votes when it's all said and done. You know, if I'm Abigail Spanberger from Virginia, for example, and I represent what used to be Eric Cantor's sister, am I going to vote for something that's a progressive priority? If I'm Tim Ryan and I'm running for the Senate in Ohio, am I going to vote for this? I just don't see support there. I think the progressives are making a lot of noise. We see the fractures growing in the Democratic conference, but this problem goes way beyond Manchin and Sinema. And the fact that these bills are not going to be 100% paid for is also another problem, because there's more and more fears of inflation. If we're going to be pumping more money into the economy and also adding to the debt, we saw consumer prices go up again this month. I think that there's going to be a lot of fear on both sides.
Well, look, on inflation, we're going to see that sort itself out, right? There's demand as people are coming back out and buying and driving and doing all of that. The Colonial Pipeline impacted that a little bit. Let's go to the international front, where we've got two august commentators. Jim, it's great to have you back. Patrick, thanks very much for joining us again. Dove, as always, for making time for us. Jim, talk to us a little bit about where we are now, right? I mean, President's making his first trip, underscoring a lot of very, very important messages. I think it's very, very powerful symbolism to an American president that sees himself, that who's, you know, his hero is Franklin Roosevelt. You have a British prime minister whose hero is Winston Churchill, on whom he's famously written a book. In the background was HMS Prince of Wales. The two leaders in 1942 did sign the Atlantic Charter that became a foundational document for global human rights, and kind of, you know, at a key time when democracy is under pressure, you have two of the nation's most prominent democracies kind of coming together to send that message. There is a disconnect growing in NATO between Washington and Paris, and there are a lot of nations standing behind Paris. And I think, you know, Paris is making a very reasonable point. We're okay with spending more money, Jens Stoltenberg. What exactly do you want to spend this money on? And that's not abundantly clear what the alliance would spend more money on. I know that from an American perspective, the American administration wants to see Europeans spending more money. That was a message that Joe Biden took often, even when you were in the Pentagon, to Europe. Bob Gates did the same thing. You guys ought to be spending more money. Trump was a little more brutal about it. And then we have the issue of Putin and the summit the president's going to have, where it doesn't appear Vladimir Putin gives a damn what anybody has to say. Biden said, don't make trouble. We've at least got three troubling things he did. Cracked down entirely on the Russian opposition to the point he's crushed it. Sending stuff to, you know, technology to Iran, that's going to be very problematic. And then an American, one of the two Americans that the Russians have accused of espionage wrongly, has disappeared from American embassy site. Walk us through the week, what we've accomplished, what we should expect at the G7 and the NATO ministerial and the meeting with Putin.
Well, Vago, my head hurts just hearing you go through that laundry list. And I'm so happy you're going to give me the entire podcast to go through all of those things.
you're always welcome on, right? You can use Brussels sprouts to do that at CNAS, and you're always welcome on this one as well.
Well, this will be part one of a five-part series as we walk through what's going on. But just a couple of remarks to get us started, and that is, you know, I think we have to go back to what Mike was just saying, actually, and review, as he's already done, the political situation here in the United States and in Washington, D.C., on the Hill. Because that's really what the administration is focused on, and that's where the success of the administration and the electoral success of this administration lies. It's on the Hill. It's infrastructure. It is racial equity. It's dealing with so many of the problems, the southern border, so many problems that we have here at home. And so suddenly for the president to pick up and fly to Europe for a series of summits was a little jarring. I mean, I'm a transatlanticist. I'm not disappointed. But when you look at the priorities of the administration writ large, going to Europe and talking about these things certainly wasn't number one. If you look just at foreign policy, you know, I don't think necessarily the transatlantic relationship was number one either. I think it's China. And then there's a great gap between China and then you have Russia. And then, of course, dealing with those two foreign policy challenges rests with our allies. And so it is a big thing for this administration to go to NATO, to go to UK and other places, the G7, the EU. He's going to be there as well. That's important to kind of begin the process of not just repairing, but trying to regain some of the trust from a lot of European governments that are hedging a little bit because they don't know if if they don't know which is the flash in the pan. Is it Trump or is it Biden? The midterms are right around the corner, and I think everyone's watching that to get an indication. So, you know, this trip, while a bit jarring, given all the things that are happening at home, is important because we've got to get the allies alongside with some of the trust restored so we can deal with China, particularly. Well, Europe's got a role in that, and we can certainly talk about that, but to deal with Russia too. There's climate change in there. There's the pandemic and other reasons why we need to have a strong alliance. So I don't want to say that this isn't important, but when it comes to priorities, given the overheated U.S. domestic politics, going to Europe within the first, just after the 100 days, is pretty interesting, politically jarring, I think, but interesting. In a lot of ways, this isn't a big heavy lift, at least the first couple of meetings. So the meeting in the UK, the G7, you know, this, you know, they've announced, more vaccinations that the US is going to provide, et cetera. That's a pretty scripted G7. It's not just a Europe thing. It's the G7, as we know, is broader, dealing with a lot of broader topics. The bilateral aspect of this was important for Boris Johnson. He needed to begin to curry favor with someone who's not Trump. So Johnson is backing and filling quite a bit to try to be a buddy to Biden. And Biden is a great politician. Biden's not going to have trouble. He understands the importance to the UK and the US in a lot of ways, the so-called special relationship. So Biden is going to play along. He's not going to make it tough on Johnson. They did this Atlantic Charter that you mentioned, which is, you know, that's nice. Got that, you know. But that Atlantic Charter bit, you know, we've got a lot of rhetoric out of this administration about, and it's over and over and over again. And I'm glad to hear it. It's important to say this. This is how you do get trust back. And we're going to get more of it when he gets to Brussels. But the rhetoric and the Atlantic Charter is an example of that. We got to start seeing some specific Biden initiatives on the table. It is easy to say all the things that Jake has been saying, Jake Sullivan and Tony has been saying, our Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, and this is all great, the speeches that have been given and that we're going to hear, but I'm interested when they get to Brussels and they sit down at the table. You were mentioning there's been pushback on a lot of ideas that the Secretary General has laid on the table. These aren't Biden proposals. These are the common funding and that type of thing. There's going to be quite a list. The SecGen has been talking about all the things that he is suggesting that the allies pick up. You know, a lot of allies want to hear a bit more, but I want to know what is President Biden going to lay on the table at this mini summit? And this is the second point. This is an easy summit because this is a mini summit. The big one is going to be in Spain next year. Mini summits are mainly for the new American president to meet his or her counterparts around the table. In the case of Joe Biden, he knows just about everybody around the table. He doesn't necessarily need an introduction to NATO or to Europe. But at the end of the day, this is a mini summit. They're going to have just, I think, one plenary and a meal together, something like that, a family photo. Each head of state and government is going to get 5 minutes to make their intervention. So there's not going to be a whole lot of opportunity or necessarily the right platform to launch big U.S. Biden initiatives. But at the end of the day, that's what I really want to see this administration start to do. I want to see that. And the reason I'm pushing is because the administration has not put into place the appointees they need to actually implement and to drive U.S. leadership in the transatlantic community. There's no NATO ambassador. There's no EU ambassador. There's no OSCE ambassador. Even in the bureaucracy, Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Assistant Secretary of Defense for ISA, Dove knows all of this. You know, there are just not the people in place that are the ones that generate the ideas, that drive the policy process. There's a lot of good speech makers because we've heard great speeches and great words. So at NATO, I was really hoping we would hear some specifics and not just a regurgitation of the great words we've heard in the past. You know, you can't say it often enough, but I want to see some meat to the sizzle, if you will. And I'm hoping we hear something. Maybe it'll be in Spain where we hear that. He's going to go to the EU. You have a question? Vago?
Yes. I mean, I was just going to interject briefly, right? I mean, I love meat to the sizzle, sizzle to the steak. Meat to the sizzle is better. I'm going to use that as a trademarked Jim Townsend line.
You've got
you mentioned EU, but also want to get your take on Russia. Given that the Russians are doing some real maneuvering, and then want to hear from Patrick in the broad, and then Dove as well. But go ahead.
Well, I think with Putin, you know, he's an opportunist. You know, when I envision Putin, I envision him as a poker player sitting around the table with other heads of state and government, holding his cards close to his vest, and playing a mediocre hand pretty well. And so that's not exactly blinding, brain surgeon stuff. Everyone that says he's doing well with a modest hand, but you know, maybe his hand isn't so modest after all. I think it was modest a few years ago. I think his hand is getting stronger that he's playing around that table. And not only his hand, but it seems to be his moxie in terms of pulling these stunts and not being necessarily deterred by a whole lot. You've already gone through, and we all know a lot of the things that Putin has done up to this very moment. You mentioned the American who has disappeared that Biden is going to have to raise. But there's a lot of things in Syria and other places that Biden is going to have to raise with Putin. And this is going to be tough because, number one, Biden himself is going to have to be tough. And you know what? I've seen Biden be tough. Uncle Joe is Uncle Joe on the hustings. But, you know, you get him behind closed doors with a problem and he can be pretty ruthless. Politically, whether it's on the Hill or with Putin. So I think there will be tough talk coming from Biden. But have we really unlocked what toughness means to Putin in terms of deterrence, and what kind of pain would really make him not do the things that he's doing, not just the United States, but across Europe as well? What is the pain threshold for Putin? And I don't think we know. This thing about sanctions, we sanction all the time, all kinds of nations. And I tell you what, it's rare to find an authoritarian who actually reacts to Western sanctions. And I think Putin is a great example of that. We can sanction him a hell of a lot. And I think he, I'm not so sure he will change his stripes. And so Biden has got to figure that out. It can't be rhetoric only. We're going to have to do actions as well. But on the other hand, we've also got some things we need to get done with him. The Democratic agenda has, of course, the JCPOA. It's got arms control. We got to work with him dealing with Syria. Idlib and the problem in Idlib in northwest Syria, that's becoming that's been raised in terms of the priority list, in terms of something we've got to pay attention to now. So coming out of that summit with Putin, we're going to have to come out with holding two kind of contradictory things together. One is a clenched fist in the one hand, and in the other hand, a pen and a piece of paper where we can start to work on problems with Russia that we've got to make some progress on. It's going to be tough. I think Biden is up to that. I think he's up to the job, but that's the heavy lift of this trip to Europe.
Thank you very much, Jim, for the comprehensive take. Patrick, I want to bring you in. This was a pre-Europe week, but it also included a lot of China news. In fact, a lot of the meetings, we had an amusing exchange where I said, the Europe trip, a lot of it was about China. You noted that maybe from Vladimir Putin's perspective, it was a lot about Russia as well. But a lot of this is about China. The United States labeling, obviously, Beijing the pacing threat. We've seen the China task force try to focus the Defense Department. We saw the president on TikTok and WeChat make some changes, right? A couple of weeks ago, you discussed briefly, president added new companies to the entities list, while at the same time let WeTalk and WeChat off a little bit until the administration figures out a better strategy as opposed to something capricious, and then bring allies together European allies together regarding China. Walk us through the week and the progress the administration is making with our European allies to bring everybody on the same page. The follow-up question I have is, Europe now agrees with the United States and most of Asia that there should be a deeper investigation into the origin of coronavirus that also could become very, very problematic for Beijing. Take it away.
Well, Vago, looking at this challenge from the White House and from the coordinator's office of Kurt Campbell, along with Edgard Kagan and Mira Raphooper and Rush Doshi and others, really bright people they've got there, are driving the ideas that are trying to bring together the threads of an administration that's still a work in progress, as Jim Townsend was explaining. You know, there are things they don't control in the White House in terms of the appointments. They've got to get confirmation from Congress. So their strategy of democratic solidarity, of strengthening the United States at home, getting the numbers up economically. The Pew poll, by the way, on Biden's numbers internationally are way up. So America may not be the model democracy around the world again yet, but at least we're much more trusted with President Biden. That's a start. And the trip to Europe, let me just defend that from an Asian perspective. First of all, G7, as we mentioned, I mean, you include Japan. So you take our cornerstone ally and you make sure that they're a global player. Secondly, you invite Australia and India. So you've got the other Quad members. So the quadrilateral security sort of dialogue is flexing its muscle even without saying it's the Quad. And you invite South Korea, our other main Northeast Asian ally, to this event as well around the G7. And so you've got a great significance. Plus, you're getting Europe into the fight. You're getting them into the question about how do we deal with the China challenge, as well as other global challenges like climate change and COVID. So I think this is a very important trip. Yes, we've had 100-day reviews on supply chains, for instance. And so we've seen mixed messages there. People want to know, especially the China watchers, they want to know, is Biden, how is he different from Trump? And they're looking at a couple of things right now. One is, where does he differ from Trump on trade? He's not after tariffs, he's after industrial policy. And so if you keep 59 countries off limits to US investors, that looks a lot like Trump. And in fact, Biden tried to strengthen the sustainability and enforcement function of those off limit, the entity listing of Chinese companies like Huawei. But as you mentioned, TikTok, WeChat, he's giving them a reprieve. So he's not going as far. He's not trying to use a blunderbuss to go after everything China. He's trying to differentiate, which is a big challenge, and we'll see how well they do going forward. But they're trying to differentiate. But at this point, they're still looking tough on China, still looking confrontational. That's because they haven't been able to get to the question of strategic dialogue with China. Unlike dealing with Russia, where you might be able to find an arms control issue up front to deal with, Russia, there's nothing there with China. China's not giving the green light to anything that the United States is recommending on strategic dialogue. They're resistant. So a lot of the dialogue we hear on Capitol Hill and elsewhere are Americans debating Americans about how to have strategic restraint and confidence building measures. China's not having any of it. The administration's still looking for that. I suspect they will get to high-level strategic dialogue that'll be focused around emerging technology and other issues in the future, but it's going to take some time and China's going to have to be a player. I think the democratic solidarity agenda here is important, but same thing, there are real steps being done. So Eli Ratner, leading the task force at the Defense Department that's now been stood down, they've got a classified memo, so we can't, you know, nobody can talk about sort of what's really in that memo. The one thing that they did that was public was to make sure that the professional military education system is focused more heavily on China as the pacing threat. We heard the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Testimony Milley. We heard the Secretary of Defense, Austin, all talk about China challenge rising, increasingly competitive. So there's no surprise. There's nothing really hidden out of sight. And I know Eli Ratner so well, having worked with him for years. He's super smart, but he's also very clear about enumerating specific tasks that have to be done. So I assure you, without having looked at the memo, that classified memo says DOD has to do the following things. And they're real changes, but they will take time. And I think some of them will become public sooner rather than later. Overall, you know, from the G7 in the UK with the Atlantic Charter, rallied the allies around first principles with the G7, you know, and with NATO, show that transatlanticism is alive and well globally, not just to deal with Russia, but to deal with China, that we have a rules-based system. That's why India and Australia and ROK are there, that we're competitive technologically. We're going to be protecting our supply chains. Taiwan is an interesting case here that we could talk about because on the one hand, we just had Senators Duckworth in Sullivan and Coons in Taipei. And the next day, China was doing an amphibious landing drill. to send a signal to Taiwan. We're investing with this Endless Frontiers, as it was called, technological sort of innovation investment from Congress, if that goes through in the House. We're investing in semiconductors because we're worried that Taiwan has been a single point of failure for semiconductor manufacturing in part. At the same time, we're trying to enhance our trade and investment framework agreement talks. USTR Tai has said that she's going to restart those talks toward a TIFA agreement, an advanced trade agreement with Taiwan. So it's interesting that we're moving both directions. We're increasing our relations with Taiwan, but we're also hedging our bets like everybody else about supply chains. And we're going to put down a marker in Switzerland, right, with Putin. I think the Putin meeting is a bit like the Anchorage meeting, but it's at the highest level. So in Anchorage, when Secretary Blinken, Jake Sullivan met with their Chinese counterparts, they came away with no agreements, but they supposedly understood each other better. Here we have President Biden making sure that Putin understands the United States better. But I think there's at least some hope for some arms control or some other positive issue to be out there, despite the fact that Russia is indeed being opportunistic, difficult, and very hard to ignore these days. One thing that we haven't mentioned was Russia has been conducting a major naval drill in the middle of the Pacific, right around Agile Dagger, a submarine readiness exercise the United States was running. And right. They actually sort of intercepted an RC-135 US aircraft away from looking at the Russian exercise. Russia is a player in a way that is not just on its own, but more coordinated with China, more coordinated with Iran. And that's a real problem for the global order. Going back to the main strategy here, democratic solidarity. That's why you need this sort of rallying of the allies around a set of principles. And I think that's President Biden's first step. And that's what he's been doing this first 6 months in office.
Thanks very much, Patrick. Very comprehensive. And I want to go to Dove in just a moment. But I think it's great that the administration is labeling China as the pacing threat. But you can't forget about Russia. The Russians are increasingly going to find themselves in cahoots with the Chinese for no other reason than it irritates us. And the Russians are a Pacific power as well as a Mediterranean power, a Northern Fleet power, and an Atlantic power. So ultimately, and it's a country that's willing to flex its muscles in ways that we have not seen since the Cold War. And in fact, Vladimir Putin idolizes the Soviet Union and wants to see that. Jim, I thought it was very funny. You know, you were showing us a Soviet Navy commissioning pennant, right? The slip of the tongue that I and a number of other people make when we talk about the Soviet Union is very much, in fact, Soviet tactics that have been freshed up with some new technology. What the Russians have always tried to influence elections. It's just the 2016 election was the first time that a major American political candidate didn't go to the FBI, as did Adlai Stevenson and others, but actually accepted help from the Russians. Dove, you've been very patient. We've heard from everybody looking to you to tie some of these threads together as our sort of geostrategic commentator.
Well, thanks very much. First, I mentioned to you all before we got on the air that when I was working in ISP around 40 years ago, I was given a poster of Russian tanks. And it was meant to be a tourist poster, and it said, Russia, not the Soviet Union, Russia, visit us before we visit you. And I think 40 years later, we're seeing that again. We've heard an awful lot of really good material up to now, so all I can do is flesh out a little bit on some points. The first one is, you rightly said, Russia is not just a regional power, as I think Mr. Obama put it, but really is a worldwide power. And the fact that the Russians are selling a spy satellite to Iran means that they're effectively giving the Iranians the ability to monitor whatever we're doing in the Middle East and whatever the Israelis are doing in the Middle East. Now remember, we've still got a lot of bases there. Even with the pullout from Afghanistan, we're gonna have over 40,000 troops around there. We still have a major commitment there, and giving the Iranians that ability is really very troublesome. And while I'm on the theme of Iran, Iran is sending two ships, a destroyer and a support ship across. They're in the Atlantic now. We think they're headed for Venezuela. Iran is apparently selling to Venezuela some small missile boats, the kinds that they use to harass American ships. So that's deeply troubling as well. And then there's the question of, what, while we're still on sort of the Middle East or Central Asia, what is NATO going to do once we pull out of Afghanistan? We're supposed to continue training. We're supposed to fight terrorism. Presumably, we're going to do that from the Gulf bases, maybe training in Europe. There's been some mention of that, but there's nothing definite there. We'd like to get back to Central Asia, but again, the Russians come back into this, as do the Chinese, pressuring the Central Asians not to let us back. The Uzbeks kicked us out in 05. We left a couple of other places some years later. There's going to be pressure not to let us do that. Can NATO do it? Can NATO help? How can NATO help? Maybe that's where some of this money that Stoltenberg wants to get could go to. We have allies who have bases in the Gulf, not just us. Turkey's there, by the way, and the Turks. I was on the on Zoom with Istanbul just yesterday with a bunch of very, very well-connected people over there, and the Turks might want to stay in Afghanistan. Mr. Biden's going to be meeting with, among others, Mr. Erdogan. That's going to be an interesting meeting, given the friction we've got with Turkey. But the French are also in the Gulf. The British are in the Gulf. Maybe somehow NATO can continue to play there as they've played up to now. One issue that hasn't been mentioned, but, you know, Mr. Biden is a good Irishman. And one of the major problems between Britain, Ireland, and the EU right now is that the Good Friday Agreement that George Mitchell negotiated and that has kept the peace in Ireland after hundreds of years of friction and war and death is really in trouble now, because the EU and the Brits cannot figure out how exactly to deal with the Northern Irish Irish border in terms of trade, in terms of paperwork and everything else. Maybe Mr. Biden's going to offer, or maybe he already has, I'm not aware, of a U.S. mediation. I know we were sort of mentioning that, Washington was talking about that, but that's a major issue for the Brits and for the Irish and for the EU, and that may be something that we need to watch. One other area I think is very important to consider in terms of how Mr. Putin views Biden and the United States, apart from Putin poking us in both eyes and elsewhere, is the fact that we have just lifted sanctions against three Iranian individuals and two Iranian companies. We've imposed some other sanctions, but those have to do with the Houthis. It's got nothing to do with other with the reasons the original sanctions were imposed. And everybody thinks this is just another example of us running after the Iranians in order to get a deal. It's certainly not a sign of strength. I think it might register with Putin, not just with Mr. Khamenei back in Tehran. And finally, the Israelis looks like they're going to have a new government, but it isn't bye-bye Bibi, which a lot of people would like to hope for. He's going to be the leader of the opposition. And even though the Likud party has put out that they want a peaceful transition, which considering where they've been is also some kind of progress, Bibi Netanyahu was leader of the opposition when Yitzhak Rabin, with whom I was quite close, was being vilified as a Nazi. He never said anything to stop the crazies. And of course, Rabin was assassinated. He's going to be leader of the opposition again. He has not said anything about peaceful transitions. He continues to call it a fraud. And so even with a new government, watch for stability in Israel. It may not be there.
I admire the chutzpah of modern demagogues. Oftentimes, the ones who are doing the cheating, accusing everybody else of frauds of the century. So I always find that to be intriguing. And I should point out for our audience to check out in The Hill, Dove, your piece, Biden and NATO must face the consequences of America's withdrawal from Afghanistan, obviously consistent with your view that the withdrawal is premature, a thought that I share. you mentioned, and a number of you have talked about American political division. And Michael, I want to bring you back into the conversation here about divisions in the Democratic alliance and why it could be problematic from a broader electoral standpoint. Ilhan Omar, obviously making some comments this week that were problematic. Talk to us about what she said and what does it mean and how it may not be as helpful to Democrats as progressives might think it is.
So earlier this week, Ilhan Omar compared Israel to Hamas and the Taliban. And, you know, it sparked a rebuke from many of the Jewish members of Congress and has put Pelosi and the Democratic leadership in a very difficult position, very similar to the position that Kevin McCarthy has been in with Marjorie Taylor Greene. And, you know, Pelosi led the Democrats to punish Marjorie Taylor Greene and really kind of took that off of McCarthy's plate. But this one's going to rest solely now with Pelosi. And, you know, the divisions have been sparking for a while. It's not just this comment that Omar made, but even before that, you know, a lot of Democrats, not just members of the squad, but other Democratic members were very critical of Israel's campaign against Hamas about two weeks ago. And I've been texting with several of the Jewish leaders on the House side, and they are just apoplectic about what's going on within their conference. Very surprised about statements made. I mean, things you would never think that you would hear from even defense leaders on the Democratic side saying that we should withhold arms sales to Israel. One defense leader on the Democratic side, I won't name names, but said that it was tone deaf for us to be selling weapons to Israel at a time when they're bombing Palestinian families. Obviously, many of the Jewish members of Congress pointed out no one seems to care when Jewish families and Israeli families are being bombed. So this is just one of the many tensions that we see blowing up in the Democratic conference. I think, you know, it also goes into what we're seeing happening with infrastructure, where the progressives are pushing this reconciliation package. They don't want bipartisan talks. They want to ramrod something through, at not thinking about the fact that they may not have the votes to ram it through. And if they do, not thinking about the fact that they would definitely lose the majority. There are a lot of, you know, they only have a 5-seat majority in the House. And there are a lot of Democrats that are very concerned who won Republican seats in 18. New lines are being drawn for 22. And that if they vote for some of these things the progressives want them to, that they're going to lose their seats and they're going to be serious repercussions and they're going to be out of power. So those problems are only going to get worse for the Democrats as time goes on. I mean, I think, you know, the president used a lot of his political capital to get what he considered the American Rescue Plan passed. And look, it's true. Some Republicans are out there touting some of the successes of that plan, even though they voted against it. But there's a lot of buyer's remorse from Democrats from that plan because, you know, there is a conception that people are being paid to stay home and not work, that there are shortage of labor, you know, across the restaurants here in D.C. and across the country. I see it with some of my clients with shipyards and other places that we can't get people to come back to work. And the fact that we did give stimulus checks to people who didn't lose their jobs. These are things that are going to pile up and be using campaign ads against Democrats in the next election.
And I have to point out, right, that, you know, defund police, crime rates rising, right? I mean, there are a whole bunch of things that Republicans will be able to use as cudgels, you know, against Democrats who believe that they can still focus the Republican Party on Donald Trump, even though a lot of folks who are pro-Trump are running against Trump. In some local elections, as we've seen, right, the Republican candidate for Governor Glenn Youngkin is pro-Trump, but moving away from Trump in terms of his messaging to try to get elected in a purple state where Terry McAuliffe still has a lot of traction. Dove, just very quickly as we wrap up, any thoughts on the Ilhan Omar comments and the blowback from that? And then Jim and Patrick want to go come back to you guys very briefly before we wrap up. Go ahead.
Yeah, really what you're seeing here is an ailment that frankly ails both extremes of the two parties, which is they'd rather be what they consider to be right than necessarily get elected. And if you look at most of the primaries on the Democratic side, it wasn't just Virginia that elected a moderate in the primary, but pretty much around the country, the extreme left wing did not do very well at all. And that's really a message that Pelosi in particular has to, and Schumer have to digest, because the more they will give in to that noisy progressive side, the less likely it is they're going to hold Congress.
Jim, CNAS is having its big annual conference. You want to talk to the audience about some of the key takeaways you guys have had so far and what you've got planned, because you guys are doing this. Normally, it would be a day and a half, 2 day extravaganza, and you guys have kind of stretched this out a little bit of a lighter lift across a broader number of days. Talk to us a little bit about some key takeaways and what you guys are trying to accomplish, because it is one of the most thoughtful highlights of the year here in town.
Well, Vago, thank you very much. I think what I would say is that one good thing about having to do the conference the way we're doing it now is that if you miss something, you can go back and see it, because we're all on Zoom and it's stretched out over time. And so the pace is a little less breakneck. You know, when we do it in person in downtown Washington, it's it can be a crazy set of days. But
It's called brutally grueling. Brutally grueling, intellectually rewarding, but brutally grueling.
And just try being the CNAS staff as they put it on. It's pretty tough. But I think Kath Hicks, you know, was there, and a lot of great speakers. We did a Brussels sprouts, actually, that I thought was very good. Susan Glasser and Steve Erlanger. Ann Guerin from the Washington Post, who was on the podcast while standing on the tarmac at Cornwall. It was very good. And I flagged that only because I think a lot of what Susan said and Steve, the reflections they had were excellent on this. And I would really recommend you all taking a listen to it. And it's great. And of course, the events aren't over yet. There's more to come. Just one last point before giving the microphone back to you. And that is, I don't want to understate and underplay the importance of the Biden visit to Europe and all the various summits and what they're trying to do in the rhetoric. My core point here is that I want to make sure that Europe, in fact, can be a priority, can be higher up on the priority list for this administration. Right. I'm not sure it is. So what I'm trying to do is kind of hold their feet to the fire and say, love the words, but we really need to see the people, and we need to see the Biden initiatives to bring strength to the alliance. To deal with Putin, to work with the European Union, we're going to have to do that. And then G7, which I didn't talk too much about, but I thought Patrick did a great job. I think there's a lot there, the G7 too. So my final point is just that that this trip is important, and I'm glad it happened. And the G7 was what really propelled it. They were going to Europe to do that, and so that led to these other summits. So I'm glad it all happened, but you know, it's more than just visits and handshakes and family photos. I want to see people, butts in chairs, as they say, and some good ideas being rolled out on the tables in Europe to deal with problems that we all share globally.
And Patrick, what should we expect in the wake of these summit meetings, right? Because the administration has been looking at building momentum at each point. I have to say, you know, there were critics who were saying they're not going to be tough on China. They've proven to be tough on China. They're proving to be more organized and concerted. And one thing we didn't talk about, and I'll give you the last word on it, is Wuhan and how a global consensus that appears to be arising. Nobody is blaming any, you know, China for the deliberate nature of this, right? It was not created in a Chinese lab and deliberately released, which is, I think, a tonal difference between this administration and the last. But scientists did think that it could have escaped the lab, right, in a refined form, which makes it more dangerous. And a number of medical professionals have said that happened. I remember that there was a, you know, smallpox had been contained, but it leaked from a British lab. And I believe once it leaked from an American lab as researchers were working on it. How does the administration capitalize on the momentum from these trips? And lastly, does global pressure on Beijing become a needle mover, because Beijing can't fight the whole world? It thinks it can fight the whole world, but it can't. And that's increasingly being clear when, whether it's Australia, whether it's Koreans, whether it's Japanese, whether it's anybody, talk about the threat and the problems and why they want more Americans there. I thought it was telling that Australia's defense minister was saying, hey, you know what? I think it's good to have more Australian forces in different parts of the country, but as well as American forces. talk to us about those two dynamics very briefly in the time we've got left.
Well, Vago, I mean, the two sides of the coin are very much sort of the democratic versus the authoritarian model of governance. And at a time in the world, it seems to be tipping toward a greater authoritarian sort of momentum, at least in terms of numbers, according to Freedom House. You've got the United States finally leading and rallying democracies and like-minded countries to kind of put up a bulwark against that. A lot of that's rhetoric at this point, but it's going to lead, hopefully, to real trade and technology policies, real defense cooperation. But the devil's in the details, and we'll have to see how functional our own democracy can be, not to mention how functional our allies can be, whether it's in Europe or whether it's ASEAN, which wasn't even able to call Myanmar on the carpet for the junta, or whether we're dealing with even capable allies like Japan, which has backed off its reference to Taiwan as a country as soon as it was criticized by China for kind of violating the 1972 communique that normalized relations between Beijing and Tokyo, and in which Japan acknowledged, as indeed we have, that there's only one China. I think the virus and the vaccine diplomacy is a good illustration of this competition between the models of governance we're dealing with. China's largely suspected because of its model of governance. That is, it has a system that has to cover up anything that did happen. I'm happened to be a COVID skeptic in terms of trying to guess what happened. I really want to see objective science brought to bear on the origins of COVID. That's why it's great, I think, that the president's asked the intelligence community, not sure that the intelligence community has access to everything that other scientists might. But the point is, while we're trying to sort that out, and maybe we'll never sort it out because China's not likely to cooperate, China's been waging an offensive that is not just the wolf warrior diplomacy, kind of aggressive diplomacy, that Xi Jinping has now said, let's rein that in a bit. Let's show that the world that we're actually a lovable country that wants those win-win solutions. The reality is that China is fighting an uphill battle at winning friends and influencing people, even in its own region. But in some ways, this is not about public opinion polls. It's about the basic blocking and tackling, the basic sort of moving the needle forward. And there, when you look in the South China Sea, when you look even in Europe, China continues to influence people in power. You know, the Germans, where are the Germans exactly on China policy? You read various things about this issue. So there's a lot of work to be done here coming out of these summits. And the second half of this year is challenged by still COVID. We forget that the pandemic is forcing cancellation of important meetings. It wasn't just the Shangri-La dialogue, which was kind of the signature defense sort of meeting for the region that had to be canceled. There's every likelihood that the ASEAN meetings in Brunei will have to be postponed or canceled in the fall, which changes the multilateral venues for projecting U.S. influence and in narrative into the discussion, not to mention just catching up with many countries at a high level. So we're challenged still in this year, 2021, with COVID. That's why it's so important that Biden, along with allies, are stepping up to the plate and providing vaccines in sort of major numbers for the rest of the world. The problem, Vago, the reality, though, is that it's the timing. You know, how much can we deliver in the next 6 months? Unfortunately, much less than we can deliver next year. And so we are still working in a space that is extremely difficult. We're still in this post-pandemic, or not even post, but pandemic transition. We're trying to get to the post, and that's been a big complication on this great power challenge that we're waging at the same time.
And obviously all eyes are on Tokyo. Tokyo doesn't want to, Suga does not want to lose face by canceling an Olympics that increasingly in Japan are becoming less popular. It's, you know, trapped. That's a part of the proxy battle with the Chinese as well. My big concern is that the Chinese will actually start getting good at this game. They have a tendency of learning. So if they actually dial back, play that longer game, I think that there is a good chance that they can still manage to outmaneuver us at the end of the day. Everybody, thanks very much for joining. Excuse me. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Absolute pleasure having you all on. Hope you guys have a great weekend, a great week, and looking forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.